Welcome to the Jet Setter Show, where we explore lifestyle-friendly destinations worldwide. Enjoy and learn from a variety of experts on topics ranging from upscale travel at wholesale prices to retiring overseas, to global real estate and business opportunities, to tax havens and expatriate opportunities. You'll get great ideas on unique cultures, causes, and cruise vacations. Whether you're wealthy or just want to live a wealthy lifestyle, the Jet Setter Show is for you. Here's your host, Jason Hartman.
Welcome to the Jet Setter Show. This is Jason Hartman, your host, where we explore lifestyle-friendly destinations worldwide. I think you'll enjoy the interview we have for you today, and we will be back with that in less than 60 seconds here on the Jet Setter Show.
What's great about the shows you'll find on jasonhartman.com is that if you want to learn how to finance your next big real estate deal, there's a show for that. If you want to learn more about food storage and the best way to keep those onions from smelling up everything else, there's a show for that. If you honestly want to know more about business ethics, there's a show for that. And if you just want to get away from it all and need to know something about world travel, there's even a show for that. Yep, there's a show for just about anything. Only from jasonhartman.com or type in Jason Hartman in the iTunes store.
My pleasure to welcome Wayne Kurtz to the show. He is a CPA and a CFP. He is the president of Carlsberg International Insurance Corporation Limited, and he splits his time between Belize in Central America and the United States. And Wayne, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well, Jason. Thank you for having me on.
And you're coming to us from Pittsburgh today. So tell us about what it is you do.
What we do is we have a kind of a unique product for a certain type of individual who is interested in moving assets offshore and having the ability to own those assets with inside the advantages of a life insurance policy. And specifically, just like the U.S. or any domestic policy, it offers an opportunity for tax deferral on the growth of the assets.
Okay. And so it's pretty much the same as the way a U.S. whole life insurance policy or universal life insurance policy works?
Yeah, the main similarity is the tax laws from an IRS purpose are exactly the same. We'll just say whole life or a variable universal life. Our product is a variable universal life. And the main difference is, unlike a domestic policy, for instance, Jason, if you wanted to go buy a policy with $100,000 death benefit, you exchange cash as premium for that death benefit. And then you might have some investment choices under there that you could pick from if it was a variable policy in the United States.
I love how insurance companies call it a death benefit. I just always thought that was funny.
Yeah. Well, you're right. It is just true. It's a benefit to the heirs, right? Not so yourself personally.
First of all, I've got a few levels of skepticism, Wayne, that I'd like you to address. So let's first just talk about life insurance in general, okay? And then you can talk about any tweaks that come with an offshore policy as this one is. So this is a life insurance company based in Belize, right?
Correct.
Okay.
We're headquartered in Belize.
And is it an actual, what is Carlsberg? Are you a broker? I mean, you're not an insurance company, right?
Yeah, no, Carlsberg International Insurance is an insurance company. No, I'm not a broker. We actually have the product, and it's an insurance company.
So do you own this insurance company?
Personally, no. No. There's a group of investors, shareholders, board of directors, same as any other corporation.
Okay, but you're the president of it?
Correct.
Okay, great. So how long has Carlsberg Insurance been around?
Started in 2003 and going through a lot of the legwork in the first couple of years of getting the licenses, getting coordination with the Belizean insurance law, and more importantly, getting the opinion letter from a U.S. law firm took the first couple of years. It's a lot of legwork on the front end. So it's been around since 2003, really with clients, I'd say 2005.
So U.S. life insurance companies like to brag about how they're 100,000 years old. You know, we've been in business for over 100 years, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, so was Lehman Brothers. that didn't work for them. So this is a pretty new company. I mean, first of all, what do you say to people who are concerned about that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, almost never comes up in a conversation, and it's kind of crazy, you would think, based on the times that we live in. But you have to realize Carlsberg International Insurance Company provides the shell or the product, but the reinsurance is all used by one of our offsetted by our reinsurance company. An example would be if someone had a $100,000 death benefit, about 95% of that is reinsured by another insurance company, just like anyone else, which is a Warren Buffett company. It's called Gen Re. That's who we use in most cases. And the other side is the assets that are contributed. And as I was saying earlier, unlike a U.S. policy, our clients don't contribute cash. They contribute assets, gold, silver, hedge funds, all these various things that make up the premium. Those are all held in what is called a separate account. So the biggest in its custodian outside. And what that means is in the event of a Carlsberg bankruptcy, let's just use that, right, as an example, from a risk perspective, the client is safer than they are in the U.S. because if you had a U.S. policy with the Prudential and they went bankrupt, you'd kind of stand in line as a general creditor. We don't carry assets on our balance sheet, such as like a Prudential or some of the U.S. carriers. They are all separate accounts. So if we went bankrupt, based on the rules of how they set up the whoever the owner is of the policy, those assets are distributed based on that. So it's very, very different from that perspective than a U.S. domestic company.
Right. But I mean, and pardon me for being so skeptical, and I don't want to belabor this point. I just want to ask it real quickly. So the insurance policy holder is basically dependent on whether that reinsurance contract is right, whether you know it's correct, that the company's going to honor it, all of that kind of stuff. The reinsurance company, this is a company, the one you mostly use. Now, you might use your reinsurance, you might use different reinsurance companies, but this one is one owned by Warren Buffett, right?
Yeah, it's Gen Re. I think they're third largest in the world. So, I mean, we're pretty conservative, Jason, because our clients are ultra-conservative group. And we have other reinsurers, but the vast majority of it goes to Gen Re.
What's the difference between being a broker and brokering a life insurance policy to another company or being an insurance company and using reinsurance? Isn't it kind of the same thing? Having someone else do the insurance either way, no matter what you call it, right?
Yeah, a little different. I mean, I'll give you an example. I mean, one of my previous firms was a company called Aon, $12 billion global company, and we were a broker. So we selected various insurance companies, reinsurance, all those various things for a client, and were paid a commission. Very different when you're the insurance company. You're on the other side, not really brokering. It's one product, one specific thing for our client from that side. So it is kind of a different world, difference between a broker and an insurance company.
And why did you pick Belize, I guess you personally, and then your company, this company that opened there back in 2005, Carlsberg? I mean, are they basically Americans, or who opened that company?
Yeah, you have a lot of Americans. You have various groups from the shareholder base and board. But I think one of the big things was, you know, some of the original founders had been working in their own businesses in Belize, the U.S. companies in Belize for some years, and found that it was on the uprise. And the biggest thing that was going on in Belize was, you know, you had a lot of new companies that were started that didn't want to pay the price tags of what it cost to, you know, open up in Bermuda or open up in the Caymans. And the big benefit, I can tell you, was purely everyone speaks English. Now, that sounds basic, and I know that not that big of a deal, but it's a major factor when you're dealing with any type of service organization in terms of customer service. English being the native language was a big driver, and I think also the education of the team that they were able to pull together. So those were two attractions. The hurdle rate of entry was less expensive. I mean, that's the other thing as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would assume it's pretty easy to like do business in Belize. It's such a little country. It's, I can't imagine the government there is too strict about getting licenses and things like that. I mean, they're probably dying to have some more businesses there, right?
They are. And it's a very business friendly community. I mean, they have a complete infrastructure, so it's not a bunch of people running a crazy area where it's just started. I mean, they have, it's kind of, you know, it was British Honduras, follows that British rule. They've got government, things of that nature. So there is some stability, and there's no question. I mean, the biggest reason, you know, people think of Belize is it's because of the diving, right? They've got the Blue Hole, people tour there. That's the biggest revenue source, no question. But they do have 5-6 different cultures that live there from around the world. You've got farming and things of that nature. So, you know, they are very pro-business. There's no question.
Okay. So my skepticism about insurance, these policies in general is, I always say we've got financial planners that are constantly trying to sell these insurance policies to our real estate investment clients. And, you know, there's that whole movement of the bank of you, the bank on yourself, the be your own bank, the infinite banking, all of these words they use to describe it. And basically all they're saying is buy a whole life policy and withdraw from it later and that kind of stuff. It's sort of a complicated deal. Doug Andrew, you know, was a big promoter of it. You're probably familiar with Missed Fortune and all of the stuff in this world, right? So my big objection to that is that insurance companies basically don't want you to understand inflation. And they're paying you back in cheaper dollars. So they like to say, well, these financial planners go around and say, well, I offer people guaranteed lifetime income. But after inflation, you know, yes, you may get the payout as long as the insurance company stays in business and everything. That's the likelihood is you'll get the money. The question is, how much will the money be worth? And I personally think we're coming into a time of pretty severe inflation risk. Your thoughts on that?
Again, I think from our perspective, the risk is to the client. It is not to us. We don't invest the money. It's a very different model. And I think that's the difference. I mean, if you ask me, would I buy a whole life insurance policy in the United States and consider that investment? No way. Absolutely not. For exactly the reasons you just said. Because most people buy or never, they don't buy life insurance, right? They are always sold life insurance. That whole agent mentality. Our product is completely different. And it is not for everyone. I tell them, I said, you know, if you've got a taxable situation, you got highly appreciated assets, you're concerned about the dollar, you want to move offshore, you're concerned of what's going on with the government, and you want some benefits from a tax perspective, then it might make sense. But it is a different type of clientele. I don't have a client that is coming to me and saying, I want to buy a $100,000 life insurance policy. Can you help me out?
What are they saying to you? What do they want to do?
It is an accredited investor who is looking to mainly have a shelter on highly appreciated assets. They own an S corporation with a bunch of shares, and they say, you know what, I might sell this in the future. Is there any way I can contribute my shares into this policy as premium? Yeah. Can you put Swiss francs as your death benefit? Yes. Can I have it denominated in different currencies? Yes. Can I stick a apartment building in there? Yes. That's the kind of client we have that, and it's not the client who's investing in the S&P 500 index fund. It's not, I mean, they might own that, but it's not. It's more of a worldly client.
So what do they do? What do you mean? Like, you know, so I have a bunch of U.S. real estate, for example, that I own. You mean I can put my real estate into the plan? What? I don't understand. You said someone can put an apartment building in there. I don't get
sure.
It.
In most cases, we would have a client that would own something offshore. It makes a lot more sense if you own the apartment building offshore. But can you restructure the ownership of your apartment building in the United States to be owned by and insurance policies offshore? Yes, all you're doing is re-registering the title and ownership of it. Now, again, got to go look through the tax ramifications of doing that because it's much, much easier when you have assets offshore. Most of our clients would do it offshore. They got a house in that they're renting in Spain, got a client, does the same thing. He takes the house, the rental income all sits in the policy, pays no tax as long as he doesn't pull it out. So it's better for someone who has real estate assets offshore versus onshore.
So you wouldn't necessarily put your U.S. real estate into it.
You could. You contribute shares, Jason. It's shares. So if you got it in an LLC, which, you know, of course, you know this world. I've been in real estate for 20 years, right? You're owning them in a bunch of LLCs, protect yourself on liability, contribute shares into that is how you could do it.
Or you can just buy a policy and put cash into it, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. There's no, you can. I can tell you most of our clients don't do that.
Why don't they do that?
In the U.S. You can buy a policy in the U.S. with cash.
Right, but aren't clients coming to you because they want to have money outside of the U.S., maybe because they're scared about what's going on in the U.S.?
They do, and again, maybe we dial it down a level, Jason. I mean, I think it's more of cash in another currency. That's what we see the most. I'm not saying you couldn't do dollars. You could keep cash offshore in a bank account and use that to fund the insurance, absolutely. But it's more of, we happen to see more of individuals that are interested in different currencies to own.
So what you're saying is they're exchanging into another currency and then buying your policy?
Yeah, or they're having that as one of the asset classes they're holding inside the
policy. So say someone comes to you and they say, okay, I've got $100,000 and I, you know, I've got a bunch of money in the U.S., but I've got $100,000 that I want to get outside of the U.S. I want to just have offshore affairs for whatever reason, privacy, asset protection, I don't know. The IRS has made it very restrictive now. You got to be very careful. You obey all the laws, of course, so that goes without saying. But what do people do? They give you $100,000, and then what happens?
Actually, they would not give it to us. What they would normally, if it was just $100,000, I just say just. I know that's a lot of money. But the first thing would be opening up a bank account offshore, okay, and having it set up. Maybe they're setting up an asset protection trust. They're doing other planning. But the first hurdle is, you know, our average premium is between $200,000 to $400,000 a year for 5 years. So this is a different type of product because it's someone who has, says they've got a, you know, whatever the net, you know, the accredited investor rules. It's either they're making $200,000 or they have a net worth
over a million.
So they're carving out a portion and they will say, I'll contribute $100,000 a year for 5 years to make sure we're compliant. Taxes work well when I pull the money out. That's kind of what we say. So if someone had $100,000 and they want to re-diversify their assets, again, I don't think it makes sense for the insurance. You'd open up a bank account somewhere, wherever. Again, you can't do Switzerland anymore. They're not going to take U.S. clients, as we're well aware. So they would maybe go, you know, Caymans, Belize, wherever, you know, that kind of thing. That would be step one.
So they fund it with $100,000 a year for 5 years, and then what happens?
And normally it would be assets. So again, they can use any asset they own. We've got clients that have collectibles in the policies, as an example. So then, you know, it's a life insurance policy. There's a death benefit based on their age that would pay to their heirs. And most of our clients are not interested in the death benefit, but you have to have the death benefit to get the tax deferred wrapper of the asset that's inside to grow tax free. So we usually will structure it where we try to buy the minimum amount of death benefit that we can, thus the lowest mortality expenses that what Gen Re is going to charge, right? They've got it based on how old you are. And of course, you got to get a medical and all the same things apply, but everything has to occur offshore. So medicals, financial information, there's financial justification, all those various things. They want to look at tax returns, you know, those kinds of things, make sure that it's financially justified. So then you have a policy that's in place. And after 5 years, you know, they can do what they want with it. I mean, they can borrow money out if they want, or assets out tax-free, or just leave the policy in force. It kind of depends. But each of the goals are going to be different, as you know.
Right, right. And what kind of return on investment can they expect?
Whatever their investments are. That's what they're picking. We're not picking. We don't do anything with the investments.
So okay. So, with the investment, it's just either cash or shares in an LLC or whatever, as you mentioned before. But what if they just come to you and say, I want to put in $100,000 a year? What happens then? They just maybe leave it in a foreign currency bank account?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I guess there's two things. The first is for any offshore policy to make sure that it's IRS compliant, the individual must have 5 asset classes. Okay, so you can't just say, I'm going to just stick $100,000 of cash in. It has to be broken up. And the way the IRS, the rule, and I'll go through it quickly, you can have no more than 55% in one asset class, no more than 70% in 2 asset classes, no more than 80 in 3, no more than 90% in 4. So the minimum you got to have is 5. Maximum, you can go, of course, more than that. That's to pass the diversification test by the IRS. If you don't, all the growth is taxable. So it's absolutely imperative that you have 5 asset classes. But the first part of your question was, what happens if a client has $100,000? Well, the other component of the IRS is you have to have an investment advisor, trustee, individual other than you appointed. You cannot trade in the account. It's not like owning a brokerage account. And those investments, we can help someone and guide them to some people they could talk to, but we do not make the investment decisions. It's ultimately up to them and their advisor when they set it up.
All right, good. What else should people know about this?
You know, I guess a couple things. One is there are some requirements that are important to file. With all the new disclosure rules, it falls under all the new disclosure, the TD90, the 8635, the new form. I don't know if I have the number right, but the new one that came out. In addition, there is a form 720 that is required. And when I talk to accountants, I tell them, make sure you have your client fill out the forms. And the compliance is important to disclose it. Just like anything else that you have offshore. There's no attack on anything other than you just need to disclose. The other thing would be if a client or an individual is looking at it, analyze what the overall costs are. It's like anything else. What's the mortality expense charges that they're charging? What is the cost for the implementation, the sales load? It's, in most cases, it can be less expensive than buying domestically because you save about 3% with not paying state premium tax that you have in the United States. So you and that's on the premiums. You eliminate that. You pay 1% excise tax, so you're probably ahead a couple points. And then you figure out what the, you know, determine what the loads are. And the loads are not like in the U.S. And I'm sure you know, Jason, I mean, the average commission rate for an insurance premium to the agent in the United States is, you know, 50% minimum up to 90%. I mean, they're
that is just insane. Do you want to just elaborate that on that for a moment? You know, so an agent, a life, no wonder they like selling life insurance, right? So, and we've done shows on this before because it's just mind-boggling to me.
Oh yeah.
But you know, no one really knows how much the agent is getting, and you said 50 to 90%.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. If it's a term policy, you know, a temporary coverage, not a permanent.
They don't make much money on those, right?
No, they actually make a lot more. Normally, it's between 90 and 103% of the premium is commission, okay? So, and then a more permanent product, the minimum threshold would be about 50%, up to, you know, 70, 80, 90%, depending upon bonuses, of the first-year premium. Then they receive a renewal going forward, depending upon how it was structured. When you go offshore, the highest I have ever seen is 5%. You're talking probably in the 2 to 4% range is the total load on an offshore, any offshore carrier. They'll all be like that. So it's a very, very different model than onshore. So, you know, the insurance agents, you know, generally, you know, and the most of the people that work in this space are investment people because they understand they charge a client a percentage of their assets, right, as a management fee. It's the same thing with an offshore life insurance. It's like assets under management because they're normally running the money that's inside an offshore policy. The reverse is in the U.S. I mean, an insurance agent in the United States would probably not be real enamored to make 2% commission on their on a new policy. They're going to be able to get something, but you know, 50% or whatever. Big difference from that side.
Yeah, pretty amazing. You know, one more question for you. You're in the same building as KeyBank, and I actually opened an account there, never funded it, but I did open an account about a year and a half ago. And I was just wondering, I went there and, you know, I just honestly didn't feel that comfortable. You know, I know this is the bank a lot of Americans use when they do the offshore banking. I've heard about it. I've read about it. But it seemed like such a little sort of small kind of Mickey Mouse operation, frankly. And, you know, they have no FDIC insurance. They did say, though, in counter to that question, is that they have much higher reserve requirements than U.S. banks. Well, I would believe that. I mean, the whole U.S. banking system is a house of cards, really.
You're right. Yeah, it's about I think it's 25% or 30% threshold is what the reserve requirements there versus the U.S. I don't know what it is. It's right now, I think the banks are at about 6%. So it's a big difference from there. But maybe to answer your question on comfort level, I think the one thing that I always mention is when I talk to a client, again, I'm not on the banking side. That's not my space.
I understand.
But it's important that if you look at all of we'll just take the country of Belize as an example. There's several banks, but you're not going to find billion-dollar banks. It's a very different model, and it's a small little country. It's like various other places that you can go as well. That's kind of the mentality that you'll find in Central America from the banking jurisdictions, things of that nature. But that's kind of the norm. I mean, that's what I've seen when I've gone to some of the different banks in the various places through Central America. You're not going to see an infrastructure with, you know, remember, none of the clients are, for a lot of the international banks, will be locals. In a lot of cases, they're just banks that will deal with Canadians, U.S., Europeans that you have to live and reside and be a citizen outside of the country. And again, you're not having tellers and a very different kind of model than walking into a, you know, Bank of America building or something. But you address great points. I mean, and I think everyone should do their own due diligence with management, you know, looking at the balance sheet, seeing where the debt is. I mean, are they lending money on, you know, on real estate, things of that nature? What does the reserve requirement look like? And you got to realize, I mean, when you go offshore, I mean, if it's a $50 million bank, $100 million bank, that's big in the Central American region. Not saying Switzerland, but we take Central America all that kind of corridor.
Yeah, you know, it's just, I mean, Belize, I went there last year. I thought it was beautiful snorkeling and so forth and diving, but I just thought it was such a primitive country. I mean, if you want to just get out of the rat race and be away from it all, I guess it's great. That's not my kind of thing. But the whole country is just, it's very primitive. There's not much of an economy there. They've got hardwoods. They've got some drug smugglers coming up through Mexico or into Mexico, I guess, from South America. You know, that's an economy. But, but you know, I don't know. Am I just missing something? Maybe I'm just being too much of a pessimist about it. Other people seem to like it. I just didn't get it, to tell you the truth.
It's a good point, Jason. But the thing that's been kind of amazing
to me. You like how I point out the drug smuggler economy?
No, I know. Well, again, as I tell everyone, you know, you don't go to Belize. You're not going to Belize City. Most people come, they go to the islands, they go to Placentia, they go to the various areas within Belize. But, you know, one thing about Belize right now, of course, they're playing the, you know, no question, the end of the Mayan calendar. Tourism is through the roof. The Bachelor, all the TV shows, they've all been filming there and all the various things. The thing that's been surprising is the vast amount of people that you will see on the various islands that come from throughout the world, not just the United States and Canada, to go to Belize. I mean, it is a very, very unique place. It's very different. It's very different than the Caymans. It's very different than Bermuda. It's very different than Nicaragua, Panama. You pick them all. It is very unique. It is I tell everyone, it's kind of a combination of a little bit of Jimmy Buffett, kind of Key West look to it on the islands, as an example. And there's been a fair amount of investment. I mean, if you go through and see who's been investing there, a lot of Hollywood is investing there. They are buying islands, Four Seasons Resorts. I mean, there's a lot going on in Belize. And I think a lot of it is it's easy to get to, few hours of flight, depending upon where the person lives in the U.S. And the hurdle is gone, which is language. And as you know, Jason, I know you travel. Most people that you know in the United States don't like to deal with the language barrier that you face in other, you know, other areas. And that's what they sell off of. So who knows? I mean, time will tell. I can tell you in 15 years, I was there about 15 years ago. The development that has happened in 15 years is mind-boggling. I mean, you've got multi-million dollar homes and you've got on the islands, you know, people building resorts and hit with the real estate recession, but nowhere to the magnitude. Of course, you know, you don't have the subprime lending and those kinds of things. So they have not had that type of downturn. Some, but not to the but it's not for everyone.
Yeah. And, you know, I went looking down there for property for my real estate investors. And we looked around with a real estate broker who took us out on a boat. That's how he showed us property, on a boat, a lot of it. And, you know, I saw all the money that was flowing in there and that kind of stuff. But gosh, you leave your resort, you leave your house, and there's just no infrastructure. I mean, it's sort of the Banana Republic kind of life. You look at Los Angeles, it's turning into Banana Republic, you know,
where you've
got rich and poor, and it's just, I don't know. I like big middle classes. It gives me a feeling of stability.
Yeah, it is very different. I mean, if you compare it to, you know, a recent visit I took just to Medellin, and you know how hot Medellin is, and the real estate market is tremendous. Plenty of Americans and Canadians investing there through the roof. You know, Pablo Escobar has been gone for 20 years. It is a completely different environment in that kind of infrastructure than you have in Belize, as an example. Two different markets, two different types of clientele. As I tell most people, if you get to one of the islands and if you go to Ambers Key, and I'm just not saying that one only, you will see plenty of infrastructure, plenty of the expats. I mean, there's a lot of expat community in Belize, and they are involved in the community. And that's one thing that I think is important. It's not just a bunch of expats that just kind of sit and, you know, play cards together. They, you know, are involved in all the various things that go on. There's a lot of things that are going on in a lot of the different jurisdictions that get the expats, and there's plenty of them looking. I mean, you saw the numbers last year. 9,000 people left the United States and gave up their U.S. citizenship. Mind-boggling to me.
That is mind-boggling. It really is.
5 years ago, there was 500. I mean, it's crazy, but you know, that's the world, right?
Well, people are getting scared of Obama and other factors. It's not just him. But, you know, the government is getting pretty intrusive in the U.S. nowadays. So, you know, things are changing. It's a pendulum that always swings back and forth. Good stuff. Well, hey, give out your website, if you would, and tell people where they can learn more.
Absolutely, Jason. The website is Carlsberg, K-A-R-L-S-B-E-R-G, not like the beer, which is the C. So it's carlsberginsurance.com is the website. There's PDFs. There's tons of information they can download from there. And then my email address is the best place to get me. It's wayne@carlsberginsurance.com.
Good stuff. Wayne Kurtz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Jason. Appreciate it.
This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.